Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the summer of 2000, today's guest, Julie Rehmeyer, a mathematician turned science journalist, began feeling constantly exhausted. She found herself trailing her hand along walls because she was afraid she might pass out. 6 years later, she woke up one morning and could barely walk. Sometimes she couldn't get out of bed. A neurologist diagnosed her with chronic fatigue syndrome. It's a mysterious disease that's defined mainly by a crippling feeling of exhaustion that does not go away with rest or sleep. Top specialists around the country failed to help her, so she turned to a non-conventional method, the internet. She decided to follow the advice of strangers she met online who recovered from chronic fatigue syndrome, and they recommended that she remove toxic mold from her environment. But how do you do that? It's almost everywhere, especially if you live here in the Bay Area. She decided to leave Berkeley, and she headed to Death Valley. In her new memoir, Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness Science Doesn't Understand, Julie Rehmeyer details her illness, its impact on her life, and the lack of research that impacts millions and millions of Americans. Julie Rehmeyer is an award-winning mathematics and science writer. She's a contributing editor to Discover Magazine. She's also been published in the New York Times, Wired, Slate, and many other publications. Her new memoir is called Through the Shadowlands, and she joins us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here.
Wow, I'm so excited to talk to you because your memoir was so gripping and just horrible, the things that you had to go through. How are you feeling today?
I'm doing well today, yeah.
And would you say it's because you got mold out of your life and you tried to get as much of it out of your life as possible?
Right. At this point, basically, as long as I successfully avoid mold, then I feel great.
That's amazing. Well, before we dive in and talk about what happened to you, tell us a little bit about chronic fatigue syndrome and how widespread it is in this country.
Yeah, it's a devastating illness with a ridiculous name. It affects about 1 million Americans, and fatigue is a part of the illness, but it's actually not the hallmark symptom of it. The hallmark symptom is that exercise makes you worse. So while it's true that patients are devastatingly tired typically, that's not at all the whole picture.
So what is the whole picture?
So the whole picture is it generally causes neurological and immune problems, and it can manifest in a lot of different ways, but one of the really consistent problems is that when people exert themselves, they feel just terrible the next day. And depending on how sick you are, exerting yourself can mean different things. So for severely ill patients, exerting themselves can mean brushing their teeth.
Wow. You write that the National Institutes of Health spends only $5 to $6 million a year on chronic fatigue syndrome, and we'll talk later about what you found, just about the industry, about the science community. But why is that number so low?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It comes down to kind of the politics of this illness. It got this ridiculous name that sounds like you're just kind of tired, dragged out like ordinary people are when they haven't gotten enough rest or are working too hard, which is really not the case at all. And it's just never been taken very seriously. And it does not have a simple physiological story at this point. We don't know. We can't look at a scan and say, oh, there's what's wrong, or do a blood test. And that makes it harder for people to get their heads around it. And there's kind of a pattern that develops with these confusing, poorly understood illnesses where they get dismissed as psychological. And that's played out with chronic fatigue syndrome, too. So it ends up being this kind of self-reinforcing cycle where we don't understand it, so we dismiss it, so we don't research it, so we don't understand it, so we dismiss it, etc.
Right, and then I'm sure that a lot of people who are feeling tired, exhausted, go to the doctor and are given a prescription for antidepressants. I've heard that from so many friends and family members.
That's right. That's very, very common. And, antidepressants can be helpful if you're depressed, and you can be depressed and have chronic fatigue syndrome, but it does not at all address the chronic fatigue syndrome itself.
How do you want the medical community to deal with chronic fatigue syndrome? What would you like to see change?
Yeah, a lot of things. So the first thing is that patients need to be told what a devastating illness this can be and that they really need to take it seriously. And the very first piece of advice that doctors should be giving patients is that they need to learn not to overdo it. And that's actually quite a skill set to develop. What I found was that if I stopped the very first moment I thought, I'm a little tired, that could allay the worst of the symptoms. But if I continued for another 5 or 10 minutes, then I would be in terrible shape the next day. So that's really the most important thing for patients to know, is they've got something really serious and they've got to learn to be really careful not to overdo it, because that is the most important thing for not getting worse. There are also a number of other things doctors can do. So most chronic fatigue syndrome patients have a problem where when they stand up, their blood pressure crashes and their heart rate climbs. And that's something that doctors can easily test for and can actually treat, and it can make a really big difference for patients to have that treated. That's called POTS is the acronym for it. So that's something that every doctor, you know, every primary care physician should know about and should treat patients for right away if they appear with chronic fatigue syndrome.
Let's talk about what happened to you. You write that you found you were exhausted all the time, to the point that you found yourself trailing your hand along walls because you were afraid you might pass out. But in retrospect, you write, the more alarming thing was that exercise made you feel worse. I mean, I just, when you wrote about how you couldn't get out of bed, sometimes it was hard to go to the bathroom. If you had to climb stairs, you had to sit down to try to climb the stairs. Sometimes you felt good enough to go to a cafe, but then you couldn't make it back to your car. Your legs felt numb. Talk a little bit about what happened from the beginning and how you progressively got worse.
Yeah, so early on, I was working very, very hard. I was building my own house, working full time. My husband was ill. And so when I got alarmingly tired, I kind of thought, okay, well, of course, you know, I'm just working really hard. But as you said, I found myself trailing my hand along the wall as I walked, and because I thought I might pass out, and that didn't really seem quite normal. But it was another 5 years before things really got alarming. And what happened was I just woke up one morning and I could barely walk. I could, you know, I had to stagger just to get to the bathroom. And that was when I was first diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And it was extremely frightening. You know, I had no idea what was wrong with me. And the really shocking thing when I was diagnosed was it was clear that for the neurologist who diagnosed me, the diagnosis really just meant, please get out of my office, I have nothing to offer you. He had no tests, no treatments, no other doctors to send me to, nothing. And so I just managed it on my own. I mean, I did go to doctors, but they didn't have much to offer. So mostly I relied on managing it on my own by figuring out how careful I needed to be not to overdo it, and had a kind of limited but fairly normal life. And then in late 2010, I was doing pretty well. I was actually able to even take hikes as long as I was cautious. And I was coming home. I was a mile from home, and I thought, I'm a little tired. And, of course, I couldn't just stop completely. You know, I rested and kept going. But by the time I got home, I was in terrible shape and ended up bedridden about half the time for the next year.
Let's spend some more time talking about your visits with doctors, because you're a science writer, so you're a very good advocate for yourself. I mean, that's usually a big problem, is that people really need advocates when they go to the doctor, especially when we're talking about something like this. You went to some of the best neurologists in the country. I mean, you even went to UCSF.
That's right.
Talk a little bit more about what happened during those appointments.
Yeah, when I went to UCSF, I went to a a neurologist who specialized in gait disorders, which seemed appropriate because my most dramatic symptom was that I would suddenly be unable to walk or barely able to walk. So I went to see him, and I actually went for a bike ride a couple of hours before and intentionally overdid it to make sure that I would be crippled for my appointment. So the doctor watched me stagger down the hallway and didn't recognize it as any kind of gait that he recognized as being indicative of an illness that he knew. And so his conclusion was that I was suffering from, or might be suffering from, conversion disorder, which basically means it's all in my head.
And then you said, fine, then what do I do about it? And he had nothing to say and shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing that I found so distressing, really, about these psychological explanations. I mean, you know, okay, I can get over finding them offensive if there's something I can do about it, mm-hmm. right? You know, if they had some treatment for me and, you know, if I could, like, fix my thinking and get better, then wahoo, fantastic.
Right.
But that wasn't what it meant when they said it. What they meant was just, go away, you're crazy.
Well, you're not a doctor, you're a science writer, and you've gone through this. What advice would you give to people who are frustrated? We often hear that people go to doctors and they just don't get the information that they're seeking, or they don't get any answers at all. And these days, I mean, doctors still really are not asking patients, based on what I'm hearing from friends and family, what do you eat? Do you sleep well? Right. Are you exposed to mold? Just these very basic questions.
Right.
So what advice would you give?
Well, I think it's really important to see yourself as the one who's in charge of your own health and your own treatment. And doctors ultimately are resources for you to make use of. And in that context, then it's annoying that doctors aren't better than they are, but it's not a devastating roadblock. So I would really encourage patients to kind of turn to every resource they can and see doctors as just one of those. And in particular, there's an incredible wealth of information in online patient communities, and you kind of have to develop a set of skills to navigate these patient communities, because, of course, along with a lot of wisdom, there's also a lot of garbage.
Right.
You know, we all see terrible health advice online, but among that garbage are some real gems that you're just not going to be able to find any other way. So diving into patient communities, connecting with other patients who are dealing with similar problems, learning from their experiences, getting their support in finding your way through, I think those are really, really essential things if you're dealing with a problem that's not well understood.
What was that experience like for you as a science writer, meeting people on Facebook who have similar symptoms and then going into these various chat rooms,
right,
and learning about these people who call themselves moldies? And at first you thought, am I really going to take this advice where I've been to a bunch of neurologists and nothing's helping?
Right. So initially I was super skeptical. What happened was that I wrote an article for Slate about chronic fatigue syndrome, and I kind of came out publicly as having the illness for the first time. And so I got contacted by these patients who said that they had been as sick or sicker than I was with chronic fatigue syndrome, and they had taken extreme measures to avoid mold and had had dramatic improvements. And I thought, well, you know, these people are just cracked. Like, anybody who gets better, comes up with some explanation for why they've gotten better and believes that they've found the, you know, they've cracked the illness for everybody. and of course, it's easy to draw wrong conclusions, and so I was extremely, extremely skeptical. But at the same time, I kept talking to them, and they were a really impressive group of people. You know, there was a Harvard-trained lawyer, there was an MIT-trained computer scientist, there was an art history professor. These were, you know, really smart, thoughtful people. And so I kept talking to them, and I was also really influenced by a young man who had spent 2 months living in a cargo trailer in the desert, and he posted pictures of himself running through the wilderness again and lifting weights. And that was really amazing, because you don't see those kinds of improvements in patients, in chronic fatigue syndrome patients who have been really, really sick. You know, that's just not a common experience at all, and seemed kind of beyond what you could easily explain away. So anyway, I kept talking to them, and I ultimately felt like what they were saying really made as much sense as anything else I'd heard, including from all of the fancy specialists that I'd seen. So I continued to be skeptical, but I decided it was worth pursuing a little bit more, and their advice was to go to the desert for 2 weeks with none of my own belongings to get clear of mold, and their prediction was that I might or might not feel better while I was there, but that then when I went home, I would react really clearly and strongly to my own stuff, which they said was all contaminated with mold.
And there's a Bay Area connection here, because you lived in Berkeley, and a few of the people in the group asked you to provide a detailed history of your illness, which you did, and one patient wrote back, fingering the culprit, the city of Berkeley. She pointed out that it was only after you moved to Berkeley that your illness really got serious. She said that Berkeley is an especially bad place for moldies. A lot of people listening right now live in Berkeley and the Bay Area. What have you found since then? What does the science tell you about mold in the Bay Area?
So the science tells me very little. When I've talked to people who specialize in air quality issues, there's nothing that they finger in particular in Berkeley, though certainly there are, you know, plenty of moldy houses in the Bay Area. However, my experience is that after I had gotten much better, I went back to Berkeley just to see, you know, I was just kind of curious, because I found that theory about there being something in the outdoor air in Berkeley that was bad, I found that theory doubtful. Mm-hmm. So I went back, and it was the most amazing experience, because just driving through Berkeley, it felt as though there was this, like, patchy fog that was invisible, and as we drove along, like, I would drive into it and suddenly feel as if my nervous system was being crushed, and then two blocks later I would feel fine. Wow. It was really, really an amazing thing. So I don't know what is going on with that phenomenon. I do know that there are many moldies who have a history of getting sick in Berkeley, and certainly I would not say at this point that we have evidence that there's some, you know, any kind of, like, impressive scientific evidence that there's some problem with the outdoor air in Berkeley. However, I would say if you live in Berkeley and you're having strange problems that can't be explained any other way, it's worth considering that this is something that is reported in a fairly consistent way and might be factoring in.
Today we're speaking with science writer Julie Raymeyer about her new memoir, Through the Shadowlands, a science writer's odyssey into an illness science doesn't understand. She spent many years battling a mysterious illness so severe, at times she could not even walk or get out of bed. Top specialists told her she had chronic fatigue syndrome, but they couldn't help her heal. So as she's been saying, she went online, followed the advice of some strangers she met with similar symptoms, and tried to get mold out of her life. So she drove to Death Valley to test the theory that mold was making her sick. And sure enough, she found that it was. If you have any questions or comments for Julie, we'd love to hear from you. If you have been dealing with exhaustion and rest and sleep just doesn't help, if you have any stories about visiting doctors, we'd love to hear from you, or mold. So many of us live in old homes in San Francisco or Berkeley in the Bay Area, and we've got a lot of moisture in those homes. So what are your thoughts on that? And if you're a doctor, if you work in the medical field, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Phil, who's calling in from New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks. I just wanted to chime in with my two cents as somebody who's had this since January of 1986. I don't know if you remember the week the Space Challenger blew up. It's Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, but that's when I first came down with something that initially it looked like a flu, and it just didn't go away, and it persisted and persisted, and I went through the gamut of infectious disease specialists. This was well before they came up with the term chronic fatigue syndrome, which, by the way, I agree with the author, is just a loathsome term, because it, to 9 out of 10 people, when you say you have chronic fatigue, they think you're a malingerer. Mm. They think, you know, oh, you know, you just can't get out of bed. You're just lazy, et cetera. And over the over 3 decades that I've dealt with this, I've seen sort of ebbs and flows of theories of it was Epstein-Barr virus. It was other types of viruses. It was environmental toxins. And I'm delighted for the author that a mold elimination strategy has worked for her. The one thing that I'd caution is that nothing, my impression in this of this syndrome, and that's is that it is it's multifactorial, and there's no single cause, and some things are going to work for some people and some things are not, and that what you really have to do is, and I think what Julie and I would absolutely agree, is you have to listen to your body. Mm. and you have to identify things that trigger I call a relapse a crisis, like, you know, you'll get these crises, and if you have a set of triggers that you can in retrospect say, okay, I did this and a crisis happened, I did this and a crisis happened, then, you know, it's the old logic, well, don't do that. Personally, for example, I don't use chlorine bleach. Chlorine bleach seems to trigger chronic fatigue episodes. It's a drag because I used to love swimming in public pools, but no chlorine bleach, no public pools, and so on. And the absolute worst part of all this is, as I said, the medical community still, from the top on down, regards this as fundamentally a psychosomatic illness, or if they think that there is something there that A, the effects of it are so minor that they say, well, you know, we've got scarce dollars, we're going to put them into diseases that are actually killing people, and B, if there's something there, the signal is so corrupted by noise, because let's say you are just depressed.
Phil, let me get a comment. We have to go to break in a minute, but thank you for calling, and thanks for sharing your story. Phil brought up a couple points there, Julie. He said that you have to do a lot of experimentation. So, for example,
absolutely,
he found out that bleach really triggered him, and you gave up gluten, you changed your diet, you did a lot of different things.
I did do a lot of different things, and for me, I really did not find much other than exerting myself that seemed to trigger it for many, many years, and then mold turned out for me to be absolutely central. But one of the points that Phil made that I think is a really important thing that I want to emphasize in this context, mold turned out to be kind of the answer for me. It is not the answer for every patient. Mm. And it does, dealing with this illness does require this kind of sleuthing process. You know, you have to be your own PI, figuring out what's going on with your body and what makes a difference for you. So I just want to emphasize, I am not saying that mold is the answer for everyone, though it does seem to be a significant factor in what's going on. And I also just wanted to say, in response to Phil, his story is a familiar and common and really tragic one with this illness. I mean, you know, the patients end up extremely ill for decades with very little help and very little support, and it's a shocking and terrible thing.
It is a shocking and terrible thing. You also point out in the chapter in your book, Moldy Science, just about the industry and industry's role in all of this. You point out that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the largest business advocacy group in the United States, put out a statement about mold, saying the notion that toxic mold is an insidious secret killer, as so many media reports and trial lawyers would claim, it argued, is junk science unsupported by actual scientific study.
Yeah, this is a kind of, this story really shocked me. A professional organization called the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine actually put out a statement saying that mold had no serious health effects. And the authors of the statement were all people who had been hired by the insurance industry to testify in mold cases, court cases, against people saying that mold had made them sick. And this was completely contrary to the science, certainly the science now, but even the science of the time. And this had an enormous impact. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce sent a version of the statement to trial judges all over the country. It basically shut down court cases about mold for now decades, even though the scientists who actually specialized in indoor air quality all agreed that this was not consistent with the science. And they worked for 16 years, I think, before they were able to get that statement taken down, even though it was clearly contrary to the science. And the insurance industry is continuing to espouse that position at professional conferences and that kind of thing, and has had an enormous impact on how the health risks of mold have been perceived in the general public.
Well, we have an email from Erica who says, we had a terrible mold situation at our home in Berkeley. We moved out, replaced all of our belongings, and took a course of cholestyramine under our doctor's care. We're all doing better, and all our mysterious health problems have resolved. We're going to have to spend tens of thousands of dollars remediating our home before we can move back in. And David writes, we set up dehumidifiers, one in a closet, one in a room. The room's moisture collection within the machine depleted quickly after just 2 weeks. We're still collecting an alarmingly high amount of moisture in the closet, 2 cups in 3 days. This is on the north side walls of a Berkeley home bordered by trees. Well, thank you for the emails, David and Erica. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org to join our conversation with science writer Julie Raymeyer. Today we're talking about chronic fatigue syndrome, the horrible illness that she had, and then her quest to find treatment. She writes about it in her new memoir, Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness Science Doesn't Understand. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You may call us on the telephone. You may send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or go by our website, yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with the directors of an Inconvenient sequel. It's a follow-up to Al Gore's award-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. It revisits climate change, looks at Donald Trump's departure from the historic Paris Climate Agreement, and then also looks at the future of renewables. And if you'd like to see the film, it is showing tonight at the Castro Theater in San Francisco at 7:30. And I hope you can join us for the conversation tomorrow. Today, we are talking with science writer Julie Raymeyer about her new memoir, Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness Science Doesn't Understand. Julie had a horrible case of chronic fatigue syndrome at times. She could not get out of her bed. She couldn't go to the bathroom, sometimes couldn't walk. And she was searching for answers. She went to many neurologists, really couldn't find anything. And then she went online and followed the advice of strangers who recommended she get rid of toxic mold in her life. If you have any any questions or comments for Julie, if you have a story to share, you can email feedback at yourcallradio.org, tweet us at yourcallradio, or you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. Let's hear next from Lee in Berkeley. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Am I on?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Here's a question that sprung to mind. I have Parkinson's, and I know I have friends who have been diagnosed with CFS. And I'm just wondering, are there any scientific studies or literature that correlates these illnesses with moisture and condensation, heavy areas, coastal areas? Because if there's a lot of mold, that would indicate it. You know, there's a lot of moisture as well. So do we, by living in coastal areas that are foggy, have higher rates of CFS and Lyme diseases?
So I don't know of any studies along those lines. There's unfortunately very little epidemiology being done about chronic fatigue syndrome. That's a result of the lack of research funding overall. However, there are a couple of studies that are relevant to your question. One is that a researcher studied the impact of mold volatile organic compounds. So this is volatile organic compounds are, roughly speaking, what we smell. And she found that the volatile organic compounds from molds caused Parkinson's in fruit flies. So the fruit flies actually shook like Parkinson's patients, and she gave them L-DOPA, and they recovered. Unfortunately, she was unable to get funding to follow up on this study. And so she's continuing to study mold VOCs, but she's not studying the human health effects. She's studying various positive effects, like she's using them to treat white nose syndrome in bats. But it's a very intriguing finding. The other study that's relevant to your question is there has been work linking mold exposure from moldy buildings with neurological problems in humans. So, you know, I'm not going to remember all of the details of what they found, but slower reaction times, you know, various neurological kind of deterioration along those lines among people living in moldy buildings. And actually a third study that I think is has some kind of alarming implications. There was a Polish study of school children, and the school children who were in moldy schools, they tested as having 10-point lower IQ.
Wow. Julie, you conducted a really interesting experiment with two identical packages containing a dozen washcloths each. This was when you're living in Santa Fe. And you sent one package to a friend in Berkeley, asking him to open it and place the washcloths around his house. And then this is the house he'd lived in that had visible mold. And then for 2 weeks, the washcloths absorbed whatever was in the air there. And then your friend returned them to you. You kept the other package in your house in Santa Fe. Talk about what happened when you conducted this sort of smelling experiment.
Yeah, so I set it up very carefully so that neither... So I had a friend choose either a contaminated or a washcloth that had been to Berkeley or a washcloth that hadn't at random. So he flipped a coin. He handed the washcloth to my husband, who didn't know which one it was, and my husband brought it to me. So I also didn't know which one it was. And then I would hold the washcloth to my nose and breathe through it for a few seconds and say whether I thought it was contaminated or not. And my experience was when I breathed through them, the contaminated washcloths crippled me. And it was, you know, very strong and very clear. And at the end of the experiment, when I did the statistics, there was only a 2% chance that I would have distinguished between them as well as I did if I couldn't really tell.
Wow. The other thing that was amazing is when you were in contact with mold and you just felt all your energy deplete, something drastically changed after you took a shower.
Yes, this is amazing that I could be, you know, I could go into a moldy building, get crippled, like just really unable to move my legs at all, and then take a shower and walk out of the shower and be just fine.
So what explains that?
Well, we don't know. We don't have, you know, there isn't really a great explanation at the moment. That's a pretty mysterious thing. One, the one explanation that makes some sense to me, you know, just kind of based on the literature that we've got. So mold toxins can actually travel along the olfactory nerve into the brain, and I found that astonishing, so much so that I had to dig quite deeply into the scientific literature to convince myself it was true, but it is true. And a study was done in monkeys that showed that monkeys who breathe the toxins from mold get inflammation in their brains. They actually lose their sense of smell. And that can happen very quickly, that these toxins travel along the olfactory nerve. So in my case, I don't think it's actually killing neurons because of this reversibility, but it may be triggering some kind of pathological firing in my brain. And then when I take a shower, then that gets rid of the toxins that are stuck on my skin or my hair or that kind of thing. And so the toxins are no longer traveling up the olfactory nerve, and then the pathological firing stops. That's kind of my best theory about it, but again, mm-hmm. we really don't have the research to know what's going on.
What will it take to start this research? I mean, we're talking about pennies. $5 to $6 million is what's being spent now. I mean, what people
right.
could do with another $5 or $6 million.
Yeah, so things are so the $5 or $6 million is for chronic fatigue syndrome research. For mold research, it's basically zero.
Wow.
There's basically zero funding for non-respiratory effects of mold. So at this point, the kind of mainstream scientific opinion is that mold can cause respiratory problems, but it can't cause neurological problems, even though there are actually studies showing it does cause neurological problems, but those kind of end up being dismissed. And there's it's essentially impossible to get research funding from the National Institutes of Health for non-neurological effects of mold. In the case of, but going back to chronic fatigue syndrome, things actually are starting to change a bit. The NIH has just in the last couple of years gotten interested in the illness. The research funding has increased a tiny bit, not nearly what we need, but it has increased a tiny bit. And the NIH is sponsoring its own study of chronic fatigue syndrome where they're bringing 40 patients into their own hospital. They're analyzing them very deeply and trying to figure out what's going on with the disease. So I am optimistic that the situation is getting better in the world of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Today we're speaking with science writer Julie Rehmeyer about her new memoir, Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness Science Doesn't Understand. She writes about her struggle with chronic fatigue syndrome, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. Unfortunately, Julie had to leave the Bay Area. She learned online that Berkeley just was full of too much mold, so she went to Death Valley and tried to get away from it, and now she lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we have a caller who'd like to know more about your Death Valley trip, Julie. Let's hear from Dee in San Francisco. Hi, Dee. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Well, I'm listening to this through with in mind that we're talking about environmental causes, just generally, not just mold, but so it's making me think about that. I wanted to say that. But I wanted to ask what, in fact, happened to, what was your experience when you went to Death Valley? I didn't hear you say about that. You know, how did it change?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I went, I felt a little bit better. It wasn't enough to convince me that mold was really my problem, though. And I was very worried that I would get unclear results and not be able to make anything of it. But, of course, the prediction of these patients was that I might or might not feel better while I was there, but that when I got home, I would react really clearly and strongly to my own stuff. So that was the real test. So when I got home, I planned to stay out of my own home and sleep outside until the next day, but I needed to go in just to get some wire clippers to be able to put my tent up where I wanted to. So I just ran in for 30 seconds and got these clippers, like holding my breath. And that, you know, maybe 20 seconds inside was enough to cripple me. So it was an incredibly impressive demonstration. And then over the next few weeks, then I did many other tests of this, you know, exposing myself to stuff from my own house, and it was quite clear that that it did me in. And then the most amazing thing, so I stayed out of my home, you know, away from my stuff, and a week after I got back from Death Valley, I was just kind of hanging out outside on my land, and I decided to take my dog for a little bit of a walk, figuring I probably couldn't do much, but it'd feel good to move my legs. I ended up walking to the top of a 350-foot hill behind my house, which I hadn't been able to do for a year and a half. And had this incredible view of the entire Rio Grande Valley, and I took a picture of this and sent it to all the friends who had been, you know, following along on this journey with the subject line, "Oh my God."
Wow.
You know, that was the first indication that this was going to actually make me better. You know, I mean, it was impressive to have these demonstrations that mold could make me worse, but the real thing was, would avoiding mold make me better? And that was the first indication that it would.
And that was in Santa Fe.
That was in Santa Fe, yeah.
You have to go to great lengths to ensure that you don't get exposed to mold. I mean, if someone from the Bay Area visits you, you have to make sure that they take off all of their clothes and put on new clothes, and they can't bring their suitcase or anything in the home. And we have an email from Ruby who says, "We too have moisture in our home, a 1894 Victorian. I have dry out containers and drawers, dehumidifiers in the downstairs room. How did your loved ones and family members deal with all of this?" Ruby says, "My poor husband has to deal with my symptoms. He's great, but I bet some have a really difficult time with it. None of us could know when we joined together for eternity that the road could involve limping, medications, huge expenses. The list goes on."
Yeah, it is really a challenge for family members. And one of the stories I tell in my book is actually about how the relationship that I was in at the time I got really seriously sick ended, in large part because of the illness. It was just, you know, it presented challenges that my then partner just couldn't really gracefully handle, and so we went our separate ways. And it's a huge challenge. By and large, got very lucky. Some patients have family members who are extremely skeptical about their experience, and I didn't have to deal with that. And in fact, 3 months after I went to Death Valley, when I was kind of in the midst of this incredible improvement in my health, but also dealing with some pretty serious impacts when I did get exposed, I met the man that I'm now married to, John, who has really... he's just extraordinary in dealing with the impacts of this illness, and I feel so blessed by him every day. You know, the basic point that this is a real challenge for family members to deal with is a very good and important one.
Yeah, tell John we all think he's pretty amazing. You live in Santa Fe. Is it safe to say that you keep kind of a small community of friends who know the drill so you don't get exposed again, or what is that like?
Yeah, I mean, my friends do know the drill. My reactivity went way, way down over time, and for quite a while, I was actually able to live a pretty normal life. Unfortunately, over the last year, I got a series of exposures that brought my reactivity back up, and so now I'm having to be very careful again. I rely on my friends to help me out. So, for example, I went to a conference for science writers during this last year when my reactivity has been very high, and knew that I might well experience problems while I was there, and so I just asked a couple of friends to kind of be on call to keep an eye on me and help me out when I needed it, and that ended up being really very, very valuable and important, because the hotel room where the conference was pretty challenging for me, and I got crippled a number of times while I was there, and my friends really helped me out.
Wow. Julie Raymeyer is author of Through the Shadow Lands, and you can find more information about her story at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Dee in San Francisco. Hi, Dee. Welcome to the show. Let's go next to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for doing the show, and Julie, for all your amazing work. I have chronic fatigue, too, but it's from virus, the herpes family virus. And a lot of people who have mold often have co-infections with other things like virus, but I just want to let people know that there is a chronic fatigue center at Stanford that is helpful, but really primarily with the viral aspect of ME, CFS. although hopefully if people pressure them, they will come more involved with the mold aspect. But I agree with Julie, you really have to kind of leave the Bay Area.
Hmm.
I did have a friend who was a Berkeley student. She was only 22, had to leave the Bay Area for mold and move to Taos. And she has gotten better, but one thing that really did help her was neural training DVDs from Annie Hopper. I'm wondering if you've had any experience with them, and also if you feel like there's any reliable test for mold exposure.
So let me start with the thing about neural retraining. So the idea of this is that that basically our brains have learned to overreact in some way, and I and Annie Hopper has a particular program called the Dynamic Neural Retraining System or something like that. And I did try Annie Hopper's program, and I happened to hate it. I just really did not like her approach at all. Mm-hmm. However, I did find some of the ideas underlying it helpful, and I kind of developed my own system of this that I found to be a valuable tool. So let me tell you just kind of my understanding of this overall. So for years I was stewing in mold, and it was directly poisoning my body and causing all of these symptoms. Then I figured out that mold was the problem, and I got out of it, and when I went into a building, I tuned in very carefully to subtle symptoms that I was being exposed so that I could get out quickly. So in doing that, that was an extremely valuable thing to do, because I really did need to drop my exposure to as close to zero as possible. However, what I was doing in doing that was essentially training my brain to react. I was tuning into these subtle symptoms, and then immediately getting out, having this kind of elaborate set of rituals, washing my hair, washing my body, and basically signaling to my brain that particular sensation is really, really alarming. And then that kind of sets off a spiral where the brain then produces those symptoms more strongly. So that actually, to an extent, is also valuable, because it becomes very, very clear when you're exposed. However, it creates a spiral where then the symptoms are so extreme that they're a huge problem. I mean, you know, like I went into a movie theater once and took two steps in the door and I collapsed on the ground.
Wow.
Well, I don't actually need that clear signal, right? That's not helpful. So essentially I was looking for ways to go down that spiral, you know, to calm my brain down. And this is not because mold is no big deal. Mold poisons you. Like, there are direct physiological impacts, and I think it's really important to keep that in mind. But on top of that, there is this way that your brain gets trained to react more strongly than is really helpful. So I developed some techniques for myself that I found very useful to kind of calm my brain down again and to make those reactions more manageable. And actually, one of the big inspirations for me in this was training my dog. You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to train my dog's brain, and I used related techniques to train my own brain. So I did find that to be quite valuable. I would also say, you know, even with those tools in my tool belt, you know, a bunch of exposures sent my reactivity back up. And until, you know, without being able to get away from that, there's no brain retraining that's going to solve the problem for me. So I definitely see it as a valuable tool that's kind of an adjunct to everything else.
Well, thanks for the call, Lisa. We have an email from Corey, who says he's a recently retired homeopathic physician who treated many CFS patients during his 48-year career. Like any serious chronic illness, it's very difficult to treat, but overall patients were satisfied with homeopathic care, and others have used Chinese medicine effectively. Julie, what advice would you give to people? I'm thinking about people who either don't have insurance or are underinsured, because those of us that are trying to figure out what's wrong with us, I mean, you're going to doctor after doctor, a naturopath, and sometimes they don't take insurance. I mean, it's a difficult, lengthy, very expensive process.
It is a very expensive process, and mold avoidance is also extremely expensive. I mean, you know, getting rid of basically everything you own and then trying to find housing that will be acceptable for you, it ends up being extremely expensive, and we don't have good solutions for that. I mean, I know patients who I am confident would improve significantly if they could get out of their moldy environments who simply cannot afford to do so.
Wow.
And it's heartbreaking. It is absolutely heartbreaking to see. You know, I would also say that, again, turning to the patient community is really valuable because it's free. and patients have some pretty good advice, again, you know, amongst the garbage. The doctors who know something about this mostly don't take insurance, but you can figure out a lot about what they do just by plumbing the patient community, and then you can have your doctor who does take insurance follow the recommendations, you know, prescribe the same kinds of treatments that these very expensive specialists do.
How has this whole experience changed your work and changed the work that you do?
Well, it's gotten me writing about chronic fatigue syndrome,
mm-hmm.
which I wasn't doing before. I was writing primarily about mathematics. It's also had a really big impact on me in that, you know, it's changed my understanding of science in a big way.
Mm.
You know, early on, before I got sick, I kind of saw science as the white hats. You know, like they're trying to do something good, and maybe they don't always get it perfectly right, but basically, you know, science is a force for good in the world. And I do think science is a force for good in the world, but it's also, in real life, it's a human institution, and that means it has all the complexities of every other human institution. And there is an enormous amount of science that's simply wrong. There's some percentage of science that's actually really kind of evil. I mean, so for example, in the chronic fatigue syndrome world, there's a group of mental health professionals in the UK that have pushed this idea that therapy, psychotherapy, and gradually increasing exercise is a cure for chronic fatigue syndrome. And they have really distorted their findings and pushed this very widely. And almost all public health recommendations around the world embrace psychotherapy and graded exercise therapy, even though the data from these very scientists does not support that.
Wow.
And that was really shocking and eye-opening for me and has left me far more skeptical and inclined to, you know, look at scientific studies with a kind of hard eye that I didn't think was necessary before.
Julie Rehmeyer is author of the book Through the Shadowlands, A Science Writer's Odyssey into an Illness Science Doesn't Understand. Julie, thank you for sharing your story. We're so glad that you're healed, that you're able to come on the shows and talk about this. I mean, I was reading your book thinking, my gosh, she couldn't even get out of bed, and now she's going to come on our show on Monday.
It's a true thrill for me.
Yeah, I bet. Well, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can find more information about Julie and her story at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.